just to give you an example, there's a company, I don't know about the pronunciation, Senatas or Senatas, provides high assurance encryption for government, defence and military data networks. Their CEO, Mr. Andrew Wilson, has recently stated in an interview on the Risky Business podcast, which was not a podcast I knew existed until tonight, that he believes this bill potentially threatens Australian defence exporters by undermining the trust of international customers in the integrity of encrypted systems sold by Australian companies and creating a perception of supply chain risk.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the weekly Risky Business News and Current Affairs podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. And what you heard there was Senator Murray Watt in the Australian Senate estimates citing risky business, an interview in Risky Business. Strange times indeed. We'll talk a little bit about why that interview was mentioned in this week's news segment. On this week's show, Adam and I are going to whiz through the week's considerable security news, and then we'll be jumping right on in to this week's sponsor interview with Josh Lemos of Silence. That's an interesting chat. They've succeeded in applying machine learning to binary classification. But what next? Where does it make sense to apply machine learning next from their point of view? As you'll hear, a binary classifier is one thing, but applying machine learning to something like endpoint detection and response or network traffic is actually a lot more complicated. That one's a fun chat and it's coming up later. But first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, this is great. Cyber Command is taking action against, possible Russian threats in the most awesome 90s IRC war way.
Yes, they are, kind of doxing them, or at least threatening to dox them. The plan that Cyber Command says that they currently have afoot is to find individual Russian operatives who are, participating in, destabilizing elections or whatever else, other misinformation, psyops campaigns they happen to be undertaking, to go find them and tell them that they have been identified by the US Cyber Command and that they are being watched and maybe they should think about what they're doing with their lives and, just generally kind of stop it otherwise or else,
If you keep using your botnet to boot me off the game server, I'm going to dox you.
Yeah, pretty much, right?
It's wild. It's wild.
Yeah, it is pretty funny. And, I guess we've seen, a lot of people have said, the way that you deal with this kind of different disinformation campaign is to shine light on it, right? And make them, to expose them for what they are. In that respect, this seems like a pretty good approach. But yeah, it's kind of hard to take it completely seriously. But
I think it'll be effective, to be honest. I mean, I just think it's funny that, in the time that you and I have been in this field, this whole sort of cyber defense sector has sprung up, and there's some really brilliant minds in it. And essentially the deterrent that they come up with is the equivalent of an IRC war from the 90s. It's wild.
Yeah, well, I guess I've often said that the military industrial complex has taken our hobby and weaponized it, like stolen our hobby. And yeah, pretty much that's exactly it. They're weaponizing IRC warring and, doxing and I'm going to phone your mom if you keep doing it kind of approach, which... Yeah, I mean, you're right. It might actually be effective, although part of me wonders, the threat of, we might, indict you, or there might be sanctions, or there'll be some other consequences, which are kind of nebulous from the US when you live in Russia versus the very real consequence of going to work the next day, at the troll factory and saying, actually, I'm going to stop now because I got some weird threats from, from some spooky Americans, when you actually live in Russia and are exposed to much more real kind of, threats of coercion from your own government in that case. So,
let's see. It depends who they're messaging as well, because they correct me if I'm wrong, but they have actually done this already, haven't they? They've messaged people and said, we're onto you.
That seems to be, the way it's written up in the New York Times is that this is a thing that's already happened.
Yeah. Can you imagine getting that notification? Right? So, and, Russia is free to play that game against the United States as well, I guess. But I think, one of the advantages that Five Eyes seems to have is better OPSEC. It's not perfect. We've seen names leak out through path disclosure and stuff in Equation Group malware and whatnot. But they do seem to be better at that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the Five Eyes have always had a strong preference for not being caught as one of the kind of key things, which, I don't know that anyone else really plays that game quite as hard as Five Eyes do. And, we don't have many advantages in this space and may as well use that one.
Now, look, staying with Russia, and a Russian woman has been charged with trying to meddle in the midterms. Mostly, it looks like her activities involve shit stirring. I mean, that's what Russia is best at, is like getting onto the internet and getting Americans fighting each other. And that seems to be what she's been charged with here.
Yes, Miss Elena Kuznayova of St. Petersburg apparently worked at a company owned by like a Putin, you know, kind of oligarch, I guess, you know, fellow businessman. They were involved in all the sorts of things that we've seen, you know, usually winding up Americans on the tweeters. Apparently she was running a team of people there. And she's been charged with interfering with the elections.
For a while, I mean, people were saying we haven't seen anything targeting the US midterms. I guess this sort of counters that narrative a bit.
Yeah, I mean, all of the, you know, indictments that we'd seen in the past were a little bit, you know, nebulous and obviously focused on the earlier things. So, yeah, this one does seem to suggest that the active campaigns against the current elections are, you know, absolutely getting the focus that you would expect, you know.
Now, look, some time ago, I described Bloomberg's reporting on Supermicro as a dumpster fire. It looks more like one of those tire fires now that burns for 20 years, because this saga, it just is not going away. Apple CEO Tim Cook, has demanded that Bloomberg retract this piece. I don't believe they've demanded a retraction ever before, so that's significant. Andy Jassy, who's the CEO of Amazon Web Services, has also weighed in and says a retraction is appropriate. Dan Coats, the Director of National Intelligence in the United States, says there's no evidence of this thing. It just, look, you know, Supermicro's taken another swing at it. It the pressure is really on Bloomberg here.
Yeah, I mean, they really do need to front up and, you know, either present the evidence that they actually have, you know, in terms of actual hardware, or, you know, start to walk it back. I mean, it is getting a bit ludicrous. And I looked this morning actually at the graph of Supermicro's stock price, and it's still down, you know, 60%. Like, it hasn't gone back up again since this story broke. And I mean, at minimum, they kind of need to take some responsibility for that. You know, let alone, you know, as you said, like the kind of unprecedented call for retraction from Apple. And I mean, let's face it, Apple's had so many things written about them that are complete bollocks in the past that they haven't. Like, it really does kind of set a bar for how willing they are to call bullshit on this.
Well, and also it sort of puts to rest the idea that they're, you know, they're staying silent because of some sort of, you know, secret national security letter. I mean, if that were the case, they're not going to give interviews to BuzzFeed demanding retractions, right? Like, that's just, you know.
Yeah, exactly right. That really does kind of, you know, put a nail in that particular conspiracy theory.
But the derp on this one on Twitter is strong. Like, you know, you post about this stuff, you might post a link to an article like this, and people will be replying saying, "Sure, they're hushing it all up," right? So there's a lot of derp out there on this one.
I mean, there really is, and I guess InfoSec Twitter has a lot of derp. Full stop. But yeah, I mean, people are poorly informed. They're not really thinking through, I think, really what it all means.
Someone asked me, "Oh, do you believe them?" And I'm like, what? Amazon, Apple, Supermicro itself, the Chinese government, the US government, NCSC, you know. Yeah, I do. I actually do believe them.
Although I do note, in the interview that Dan Coats gave to Cyberscoop, he did say, let's be clear about this. If you're a US company that believes you should limit your partnership with the US government on national security matters because it could hurt your brand, then perhaps you should think about the harm to our overarching national security interests of pursuing greater business opportunities in a country like China, where the private sector and the state often merge into the same. Which, pretty thinly veiled there.
Yeah, shade. Shade, I believe it's called Shade. But, you know, one thing I got to say, I read an editorial, I think it was in Washington Post today as well, about all this Bloomberg mess. And, you know, finally other outlets are starting to actually kick the crap out of them on this, which is, it's about time. And that is unusual too. And you got to remember too, from Bloomberg's point of view, you know, and I say this having worked in media for a long time, the reason you don't retract stories when there's blowback is because if you're doing your job right, there's always blowback, right? You're always going to have powerful people, big companies pushing back saying it's not true, even when it is, right? So that's why companies are reticent to do it. And there's sort of this convention among publications, like, not to attack each other, kind of for that reason. It's about being, you know, a unified front, you know, a check on power, all of that good stuff. But I got to say, I'm a little bit surprised that we're not seeing more public scrutiny of other work by the same journalists, because this is not the only story that they've run that is fantasy.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you're right. I mean, there's a point where that kind of the industry closing ranks on itself to protect, you know, the the greater cause of journalism as a whole, yeah, there comes a point where that's just not viable anymore, especially when it's this kind of, you know, increasingly egregious, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's bad enough, right? Everyone's yes. like, okay, it's fine, let's kick them. But yeah, we'll just see how that goes. For the time being, Bloomberg's standing by the story, which is amazing, although there are reports that other journalists from Bloomberg have been reaching out to companies like Apple and asking them, you know, for confirmation on things. So, look, I think they're looking into it. And, yeah, this ain't going away, that's for sure. Now, look, in some other news, an Equifax engineer who was tasked with building their data breach notification site after their breach, he pretty much figured out that they were the company that got owned. And so he traded their shares and he's been caught now and he's getting 8 months of house arrest, which seems like getting off pretty light for doing something so stupid.
I mean, it's a pretty funny story, right? Because he got he was like an internal software dev, and he got seconded to work on Project Sparta, which was preparing.
Why would you call it Project Sparta, though?
I know, right? But the project team were told that they were building a disclosure notification site for one of Equifax's customers, and then yeah, he figured out from the test data that the customer was themselves, and yeah. Went and shorted the stock, made $75,000 for about a couple of $1,000 worth of investment. And yeah, obviously he's now paid the money back plus a fine. And as you say, some house arrest for being stupid as well as losing his job.
Yeah. Cool. 75K. Good thinking there, guy. Like, you are always going to get caught. You're an idiot. Twitter has actually published a really big data set of accounts that are tied to influence ops. So they've like released this as a, you know, as an archive that researchers can use. That's a great idea.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. And it's quite a hefty piece of data. Something like 360 gig covering 3,800 accounts and plus all of the, you know, the tweets and the posts, you know, the content of the posts where there were meme GIFs and other such important, you know, parts of modern international diplomacy. But yeah, so people have been rummaging through trying to find, you know, figure out what there is to be dug out of that, what we can learn from it. We're seeing a few people kind of processing that data. Ours has got a few select picks and things from the dump that they've pulled out. And it's exactly the sort of things that you'd expect. I mean, the kind of, you know, being divisive and rabble-rousing in the US political arena. And yeah, I mean, I'm sure anyone who's interested in this kind of influence op and psyops and stuff, I'm sure would have a, you know, have a field day rummaging through this.
Yeah. Look, staying with Twitter and some pretty bad news for them. There was a 2015 incident where a whole bunch of Twitter users got notified that a state-backed, you know, entity was trying to access their accounts. It looks like a lot of those alerts can be attributed to this insider, an engineer at Twitter, who apparently had been groomed by the Saudi government, which is pretty bad. I mean, what's not clear to me is whether or not these warnings meant that this person had successfully access the account, because normally these warnings, you know, from like Gmail or whatever say, hey, you know, some crew has been trying to access your account, we're just letting you know. In this case, they're saying someone may have done something to your account, but considering that's an insider threat and all they had to do was actually access the account, you sort of wonder how many people's messages and things actually got exposed.
Yeah, the wording has been kind of a little bit careful weaselly. And unclear
weaselly.
On the weaseling. Exactly. And yeah, I mean, I think you're right. Like when there is this kind of weaseling, if it was clear that it had not been accessed, then they wouldn't be weaseling, I think is the conclusion here. And I mean, the list of people that we talked about this a couple of years ago when it actually happened, but most of the, well, some of the people involved were, you know, like Tor developers and things like that. Yeah, like I think that, you know, the weaseling is kind of pretty clear there.
Well, they say that your account, you know, your account is one of a small group of accounts that may have been targeted by state-sponsored actors. So they may have been trying to obtain information such as email addresses, IP addresses, and or phone numbers. I don't know. It is just weaselly. It doesn't feel like they're being particularly forthcoming here.
Yeah, they're not. And the guy in question apparently since been fired, has gone back to Saudi and has a nice government job.
Yeah, well, happy ending for someone. So that's very nice. Now, look, I found this next news item quite surprising, actually, which is FireEye are claiming a link between a Russian research lab and the, you know, the Triton Trisis malware that popped up in a Saudi Arabian petrochemical plant, you know, that was that very nearly blew it up. You know, I always had this pegged as kind of an Iranian jam, but, you know, Russia, Iran, their allies, I guess this makes sense. What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, I think certainly it's really cool to see some more attribution work. Because I mean, the Triton/Trisis malware is really interesting from a technical perspective and in terms of its sophistication in its targeting and how it attacked you know, safety critical systems. You're right. We had all assumed that it was Iran on the basis of you know, targeting Saudi. But the attribution done by FireEye is actually for, I think, one of the components or like second stage bits that was dropped by Triton, as opposed to the actual core Triton bits, which is a small distinction. But we don't, the things that we're looking at, there was a couple of, there was a file name in the build data and some activity in C2 relating to IPs that were from this particular research lab. So some of those things are related to things that, you know, very clearly point the finger at being part of the same, like the tooling is part of one kind of whole operation, but it's not, you know, it isn't exactly the core Triton bit. So it's plausible that, you know, he might have seen initial access gained by Iran and then, you know, tooling for doing safety critical systems attacks provided by a third party, you know, by Russia or something like that. So, but yeah, definitely, you know, the finger points and the FireEye's graph of like activity time mapping onto, you know, the workday in Moscow time zone. You know, that analysis is one of those ones that is always pretty telling.
Yeah. You just sort of wonder, like, why is it in Russia's interest? And I don't know. I actually don't know. Is it because they're a US ally? Is it because they're competing in oil exports? I've got no idea. I'm, you know, my knowledge of global affairs doesn't run that deep, but I'm just saying I was a little bit surprised to see that.
Or it's the Iranians pretending to be the Russians, you know.
Well, you never know, right? Like, who knows? Now, Kaspersky has apparently picked up an NSA implant and, you know, dutifully blogged about it.
Yeah, they were doing a bunch of rummaging in the Shadow Brokers dumps. Obviously, there's been, you know, it's quite a deep vein of material to look at there. One of the things they were pulling apart is a component called Dark Pulsar, which is kind of like some kind of second stage backdoor, I think, used for, it looked like it'd be used for kind of persistence and then gaining access later on if the main implant had kind of failed or something. Anyway, they pulled apart some of the server side kind of plumbing code that was in the Shadow Brokers dump. Found some like constants used in the network communications, wrote AV signatures for those, and then went looking for actual implants that were still running. And they found something like 50 instances of this implant still running in the wild where it hadn't been shut down post-operation, you know, perhaps because the systems in question were, you know, offline or unreachable at the time. Or maybe the NSA just forgot about them. I don't know.
I mean, inventory management is hard. But all of those boxes were in Russia, Iran, and Egypt, and they were typically Windows 2003 or 2008 servers. What I found interesting about this, I found my own reaction to reading this news interesting, because when I read that, I think it was Kaspersky had sort of doxed a anti-Islamic State / Al-Qaeda Trojan that was popping up in certain internet cafes in you know, hotspots in the Middle East. You know, I mean, my initial reaction to that is, you know, what the hell are you doing? But when I read about this one, I'm like, oh, well, the NSA needs to write better stuff. Do you know what I mean? No big deal, right? Like, this is not, you know, it's important stuff, but it's not, it doesn't feel the same. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. And it's, you know, it's important to be kind of self-critical, I guess, in terms of how you react to stuff. And I think in this case, right, we're talking about tooling that is, you know, quite a few years past its prime. And, you know, life cycle management and those kinds of ops is a thing that they should have locked down. Inventory management is hard, but they should be still doing it. So, yeah, I mean, there's definitely some fair criticisms there. But, yeah, on the other hand, right, I mean, Russian-controlled antivirus company, you know, turning down operations by the alliance that you and I are nominally part of. Yeah, maybe we should be like rumble about that. I don't know.
I'm not too concerned by this one. Do you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't bother me. If you're going to burn an op like a typical sort of espionage op, that's fine. It just felt to me that, you know, tipping off like the crazies, that was where it got a little bit weird for me. But anyway, you know, the Australian Assistance and Access Bill, as we heard at the intro, you know, that's going through various committees and whatnot at the moment. That interview that I did with Andrew Wilson, who's the CEO of Senatas, actually wound up bubbling up into the PJCIS hearing, the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security hearing recently. That one, they didn't mention that interview specifically, but it was clear what they were talking about. And then, yeah, sure enough, you know, it got a run in Senate estimates the other day, which is pretty interesting. And it seems like that hook there, that the defense sector might be harmed by this bill passing. This is, of course, the, you know, so-called anti-encryption bill. The idea that this bill might pass and then pose a bit of a risk to defense exports has actually got some government members rattled. And there's a very good chance now that they're going to kick the bill into next year. And personally, I think that's great because there are other problems with that bill that now they'll get a chance to look at, right? So it's been a strange turn of events. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to see, I mean, you know, these issues are super complicated, and it's good to see that, you know, an angle that hadn't been previously considered, I guess, as being, you know, that your interviewing has helped kind of reinforce the complexity of the issue and the way things interrelate to each other. And, you know, the side effects of this kind of dual use stuff that, you know, absolutely has, you know, military and defense uses as well as civilian.
Oh, look, the thing is, they've been trying to ram it through real quick, right? And that's, you know, that I've mentioned on the show a few times, that's not great. And I tell you another thing, if you want to get conservatives to back away from a bill at a rate of knots, just tell them it's going to harm the defense industry.
Yeah, exactly, right. Yeah, it's an easy trick, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Magecart, you know, this is the group who've been rolling around owning up Magento sites. I think they got Ticketmaster and a couple of other high-profile ones. They're still going buck wild, and they've got, like, stacks of 0 days in Magento extensions. This group is, like, you know, they're having a good time at the moment.
Yeah, it certainly looks like it, eh? They went around looking for PHP object injection and deserialization bugs in a bunch of Magento extensions and have been owning up all sorts of things there. The funny thing that has emerged as well as the particular bugs that they're using is when we saw them compromise, was it British Airways and Ticketmaster, they were sticking JavaScript into the payment page that would post off your, you know, your payment details to a server they controlled. One of the things they've been doing here is in payment systems that don't have that don't use the built-in payment, like the shell out to PayPal or whoever, and therefore, you know, there isn't an opportunity for them to insert JavaScript. They're actually adding new fake payment pages to take payment first.
And they got their own checkout. They've got their own checkout code now and stuff, right?
Yeah, I do like that, because I mean, there's so many people be like, oh well, we don't handle this stuff, we don't have to care. And it's like, well, actually, yeah, you know, humans are a little sneakier than that.
Yeah. And you know, it's another weird reaction reading this. I'm like, is this North Korea? And there's like no suggestion that it's North Korea, but North Korea has become such a crime actor online. I think I saw some stats kicking around this week where it was like they'd been responsible for like $600 million in like thefts. I think that was just the cryptocurrency as well. Like, they've been going wild, right? So it's just a strange state of affairs when you read about a crime group doing something and you're like, is that North Korea? That one, can't remember.
Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, statistically, North Korea, in much the same way as, you know, Trisys malware is Russian. Well, statistically, it's, you know, one of the fancy bears, right? Oh, dear.
Oh, there was a really interesting talk at DerbyCon from the WordPress security team. Katalin Kimpanu has written this up for ZDNet. And, you know, I've got to say, like, half the stories this week come from Katalin. He's still just out there being the one-man newsroom. It's pretty impressive. But, yeah, I thought this was a pretty good write-up. What did you think?
Yeah, no, really good to see, you know, engagement from such a major platform as WordPress, you know, with the security community, with the hacker community. In this case, Aaron Campbell, who runs the security team there, was talking about, you know, the ways that they, you know, triage security bugs in the code base, how they encourage you know, their users to use the base code base safely, and how they're kind of approaching the security of WordPress as a, you know, almost like a harm minimization approach, right? Like, for example, deciding to just suck it up and backport security patches to ancient unsupported versions because it just makes it better for the users, rather than saying, well, you should have upgraded, it's out of support, tough.
Yeah.
So yeah, a bunch of, you know, of useful insights for that. And as we, you know, we talked about last week, they run such a large percentage of the internet on that code base, like it's important to pay attention to what they're doing. It sounds
they're doing well. And so many of the issues around WordPress, people are like, oh, they're boring, blah, 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 you know, whatever, WordPress. But, you know, it's that whole security at scale problem. I've got to know the guys from WordFence. They make like a security plugin for WordPress, you know, and it's not the most advanced, crazy, you know, hacker deterrent, machine learning enabled, whatever. But, you know, you look at the number of customers they have, it's a lot. I think they've sponsored like two episodes ever, right? That's how I got to know them. But, you know, I've had lots of conversations with them about their stuff, and it's an interesting field, you know, because it's that whole wider ecosystem thing.
Yeah, one of the points that the WordPress guy made is that they've been cooperating with this project called Tide, where they do essentially kind of code-based quality ratings for the WordPress plugins. So when you're browsing through like the lists of available plugins, you get a kind of a star rating, which is roughly indexed on, you know, how good is the code quality, how well tested is it, you know, from a security perspective. So people can actually make some informed choices, which is really not a thing that, you know, we have a lot of in this industry. So that's, yeah, it's really good to see them doing something kind of, you know, new and a bit more innovative in a space that otherwise, as you say, would be quite boring.
Mm. Trade.io apparently lost $7.5 million worth of cryptocurrency in what the headline describes as a mysterious cold wallet hack. And I'll say it's mysterious because I'm guessing it got stolen some other way, if I had to guess. Because they're saying it got, you know, these things were protected by a cold wallet in like a bank safety deposit box, and they're calling it a, you know, mysterious cold wallet hack. No, you got owned some other way, I promise.
Yeah, like you
ninjas
backed it
did
up
not
somewhere.
Break into the bank and figure it like it that's not it.
It's funny seeing, what's meant to be the future of, you know, decentralized currency relying on, you know, the traditional, you know, classic bank grade security of a bank vault to store their cold wallet.
Oh, man.
That's the very thing they're meant to be disrupting. And they're like, oh, but bank grade security, ninjas didn't break in and steal our, well, they broke in and stole our, you know, USB sticks from the storage. But, you know, they must have, you know, had some keys kicking around somewhere, got owned, and somebody has nicked off with $7.5 million worth of worthless cryptocurrency.
Look, another funny thing that came out of estimates over the last week or so was the government here, the Digital Transformation Agency, got $700,000 to investigate blockchain and research blockchain. And they discovered that, quote, for every use of blockchain you would consider today, there is a better technology. So that's Amen. Funny. And Money it's funny, well there was a reply there from a guy I'd never heard of, actually. His name's David Gerard, but apparently he wrote a book on blockchain and about how it was kind of like all hype. And he said his reply was, this is 100% the correct conclusion, and I hope they went through the sensible process of spending $25 on my book, writing the conclusion, and spending the next $699,975 on the booze that is medically necessary to recover from knowing about blockchains.
Yeah.
And I got no idea if his book's any good, but his tweet's bloody great.
Yeah, and I'm metaphorically thumping my table in support of that guy.
Oh, man. Healthcare.gov had some sort of breach. Data on like 75,000 people was obtained. It looks like this wasn't like the end stage. The attackers here didn't get to the final stage of what they're trying to do. That was kind of my take on this article. What did you think?
Yeah, there's very few details of exactly what sort of data and kind of how it was breached. There's some mention of the interface that insurance agents and brokers use to interact with it. So maybe it was a breach of one of those companies that then led to a bunch of data being available through the interface. But yeah, it's kind of unclear. Obviously, 75,000 people means that it's not the guts of it because there's loads more people in that system. So yeah, it must have been something peripheral.
Yeah, that's the sense I get. I do, however, recall that when healthcare.gov went live, I think it was like Dave Kennedy or someone, we had him on the show, like just showing just that they clearly hadn't pen tested it. And that was the website that cost them like 11 gazillion billion dollars to develop through their horrible, you know, federal government procurement processes and stuff. So yeah, I mean, it was initially an IT disaster, and I can't imagine that they fixed absolutely everything. Oh, now, you know, we spoke about this libssh bug and we're like, it's not really a big deal because, you know, OpenSSH is, you know, really the more commonly used thing, and it's probably going to pop up in some embedded crap. Well, about that, turns out that, you know, gear like F5 is affected by this. So they're already recommending that people switch to username and password instead of key exchange, right, to mitigate this bug. But, you know, F5s are in some pretty sensitive spots, right? So that's bad. And, yeah, a lot of Cisco gear too, apparently. So this one is a lot worse than we initially thought.
Yeah,
I should explain too that this is the bug where you just send it a authenticated success message instead of an authentication request message, and it's like, yep, no worries. Like horror show bug.
Such a good bug. But yeah, no, I mean, we did kind of downplay it a little bit last week, and I was F5, having it in there is definitely a thing worth paying attention to. Cisco have loads of products in loads of important places. For them, even just producing the list of what's vulnerable to it is clearly taking them some time, which is not a good sign.
No, there's like a team of people working on it. You can just sense it. And you're just thinking, someone worm it. Yeah. Or is that just me?
That is we had that feeling around the office here too.
Yeah.
F5 one is definitely interesting. When your security appliances are vulnerable to this kind of thing, then it's, you know, that's clearly bad. And obviously, you know, a lot of people are going to say, well, we don't have our management interfaces exposed to the internet, so therefore it's not a problem. But I do note that the F5 has a like SSH application layer, has an SSH application layer gateway mode where you can use it to to like act as a sort of a bastion for Onward's access to other systems viruses. Actually, you may well intentionally have
so it's like an SSH forwarder sort of thing.
Yes. Yeah. For doing access
using libssh with that bug.
And that, yeah, that there, the component that does that, I think, is one of the ones that uses libssh. So, yeah, just, you know, don't, if you're an F5 admin, don't poo poo it just because you don't have the management interface facing out onto the network. So, yeah.
That one's, maybe, you know, and you just know that one's going to be around for years in a limited way, but still, man, that's going to come in handy.
Yeah, definitely one of those long tail bugs that pen testers really love.
Now, this story, I got to get you to explain it to me because it's about this thing called TLS session resumption. And the story is really about how advertisers can track people between sites using TLS resumption. What is this? How does it work?
So the thing here is, if you have a browser and it's making you know, a bunch of connections to pull down resources from the page, you can, in some cases, reuse the HTTP session, the TCP stream that the HTTP is running over. You can kind of keep that open, request some more stuff. There is a similar mechanism at the SSL layer where you can kind of resume a TLS session that you tore down earlier without having to go through the whole key exchange and validation process. You know, a second time for speed reasons, obviously. And different SSL stacks have different sets of, you know, timers about how long they'll keep that open. This particular set of research is about a malicious server that wants to track users on multiple sites. So say you're visiting a website and it's pulling ads from google.com, and then you go to another website and there's also ads from google.com. Your browser may reuse the existing TLS session information to reestablish a connection to pull down the ads. And a server that is attempting to correlate users across multiple sites could take that resumption information and use that to identify that it's the same session as before. You know, obviously that requires kind of deep integration into the TLS stack. So it wouldn't be a thing you'd necessarily be able to do with an off-the-shelf web server. Like, you'd have to do a bit of plumbing.
But it sounds like, just on the surface, I mean, that was kind of what I thought it was, but I just, you know, I'm simple, right? So I know it's great to get you to explain it to me, but I sort of get the impression that this is like a privacy problem more so than a security issue.
Yes, yeah, I mean, it's more about tracking users in more than one place and correlating that activity. I mean, if, for example, you were doing it, I don't know, you know, on Tor and not on Tor, that might be a case. So the Tor browser specifically doesn't do this SSL session resumption, for this reason. So that maybe isn't a great example. But yeah, there are some cases where this might be a relevant thing. But yeah, it's not a security aspect other than, you know, privacy and data mining.
Well, mate, that's actually it for this week's news. Thanks a lot for joining us. And we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, cheers, Pat. Talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Josh Lemos, the VP of Intelligence and Research at Cylance, or Cylance, if you want to say it that way. Cylance makes a machine learning-based AV product called Protect, and this is a company that single-handedly shook up the incumbents in the AV industry and forced them to throw serious development into machine learning. They've been very successful at that. Now, I had one of Josh's colleagues on a Soapbox edition of the show recently, and when I asked him which security challenges we should be applying machine learning to, he basically said all of them. Now, look, that's a fun answer, and it does make sense, but, you know, getting more serious for a second, you know, rolling machine learning helpers out into all corners of InfoSec is going to take time, and it won't always provide value. Necessarily. So I thought it would make sense to ask Josh Lemos where they're going to start, because they are, you know, obviously doing a lot with machine learning already. Now, as it turns out, they're looking to get serious about using machine learning in their endpoint detection and response software. It's a much more complicated proposition than building a machine learning-backed binary classifier. Here's what Josh had to say.
So there's a number of places where machine learning makes sense. When you're a purveyor of hammers, you're always looking for nails, right? But that's not always the best solution. So when we started off with Protect, we were really looking at how can we build malware classifiers to look at the really the content of the file to be able to make good and bad decisions about that. And that was really a market space that was ripe for disruption, right? That was a really good application of machine learning. Now, as we move more into the EDR space, it makes sense to be really judicious about where we apply ML for context. So we can apply ML to certain patterns of behavior that are difficult to pick out with heuristics or static rules. We're not saying that heuristics or static rules are always terrible. There's a time and place for those where those could be accurate. But where you have sort of inconsistencies and you need to apply that in a meaningful way, it becomes a good use case for ML. The example I like to use when you're dealing with complex events is, say you went to Times Square in New York, and there's thousands of people on the streets, and there's four people involved in the crime. How do you know where that crime started? How do you pick out that chain of events? And can we do that in such a way that we are able to accurately identify those attributes and then apply a model to be able to predict the future behaviors of that type of activity?
You're getting a little bit creepy Minority Report there with that analogy, yeah. Man. I'd rethink that one. I'm with you. It's funny, I had a conversation recently with a guy, Steve Miller, who's like an incident responder, FireEye, Mandiant, your competitor. Sorry for bringing them up in a sponsor interview, but we were just having an interesting conversation about C2. And I've always been very interested in how you can apply machine learning to some of those problems. I mean, the funny thing is most malware creators do really dumb C2 that's very easy to detect. But we got some of these new technologies coming in like TLS 1.3 encrypted SNIs. If you hard code a certificate, you can still effectively domain front through things like, you know, innocent looking Cloudflare domains. That's one example. You know, we've got technologies like DNS over HTTPS coming. So in other words, like, it's going to be possible to build better and better C2, better and better exfil channels. The number one way that I can think of to detect that, it's going to be machine learning.
Yeah, machine learning is a great application there, because there are things that computers do that are really, really predictable. So take, for example, even things like applications that use ephemeral ports. They use ephemeral ports in fairly predictable ways, but you're not always going to have access at a network level to view that traffic. You're going to need to start to identify characteristics or features of that traffic that are, you know, deviant from what you'd expect.
So yeah, I mean, it's not about you can't just fake destination port as 443 and say, I'm a browser. You know, it doesn't work, yeah. Right? Like when you're dealing with a decent machine learning algorithm.
Right. That's a great example, is that humans can be kind of, you know, relatively easily deceived with some kind of simple smoke and mirrors, but it's a lot harder to pump that through a reasonably good algorithm with a good feature set and say, not good. Or even in an unsupervised or weakly supervised case, where we'd say, yeah, you know, you've done this DNS thing like literally, you know, hundreds of thousands of times, but why are you doing it in this weird way now? That doesn't make sense.
Yeah, no, that's it. So for you, I guess, you know, it makes sense. Silence has a presence on clients already. So I can understand why you'd be looking at sort of sprinkling some machine learning fairy dust onto the EDR side of things. That makes sense.
Yeah. Well, that's really the common misconception, right? Everyone thinks that they can apply machine learning everywhere all the time with some magic fairy dust, but really it's a result of a lot of good, strong research and scientific method that gets us to arrive at those models. But yeah, in terms of our instrumentation point, the endpoint really is a great place for it. You mentioned, you know, encrypted traffic channels, right? If we're looking at network traffic at the endpoint level where things are actually truly decrypted and interacting with the kernel, we are sitting in a better place to really understand what's going on at that level. So Optics started off, and we have a couple of machine learning packs in Optics now. So we are applying ML to the EDR space. A lot of the research we're working on now is how do we extend that? How do we continue to build behavioral sequence classifiers? How do we build event-based models? And really what we're looking at in that case is doing it with ensemble models. So we're building these smaller discrete models and combining them to look at not only the content, but the conduct of what's going on in the system. So we can look at the user behavior, the user interaction with the system, what's happening at the network level, what's happening with the interaction of the process and the applications. And all of those become interesting telemetry points to make multi-model or multi-classifier decisions.
But I'd imagine it's an order of magnitude more difficult to build a series of classifiers that can be used as a sort of some sort of EDR versus a binary classifier, right? Like that's a whole different kettle of fish.
Yeah, certainly you're talking about taking it to the next level when you're having to take a multimodal approach. It's more simplistic to, even if it's you're building a complex neural network, to target a single problem and say, this is the problem space, we're going to define it in this way, and these are the static attributes, and we have great, you know, a huge corpus of well-labeled data and build models around it. It's a more difficult problem to take these more discrete models and then decide how to weight them, decide how you're going to use those to influence decisions about behaviors and events in a complex computing environment.
Yeah, no, that's kind of what I was getting. That's kind of where I was going with that as well, right? Because what you're going to wind up with is a whole bunch of little models looking for specific things. I mean, you're almost got models replacing your heuristics, right? Because you're looking,
yeah, exactly.
they're going to be much more targeted models.
Yeah, exactly. There's a bunch of different ways that you can think about that as well. So you can think about that as, with high confidence decisions, you can set thresholds to where you're looking at interdicting that behavior and putting a stop to something. Well, that might not always be the right action or policy. We may want to look at this in terms of, hey, we have some good signal from the model, but what we want to do with that is potentially increase friction. We want to make sure that Patrick's computer isn't compromised. So let's log him out real quick and let's make him log back in with multi-factor, or let's fire an alert off to the SOC, have them check out what's going on, and give them kind of a medium or low confidence event to investigate.
But see, this is the thing. Now you're starting to plug this into complicated business processes. It's not like a binary classifier where you just go, lol, that's a virus, and stop it. You know, like
it's so
much more complicated. Is that why, you know, because we have seen machine learning being used, you know, mostly in binary classification. There's a few vendors out there using machine learning on network traffic, and I don't necessarily know that their approach right now is right, but I definitely believe firmly in my heart that, you know, machine learning on the network is going to be a thing that we're all going to use down the track. But is this why we haven't seen EDR vendors, you know, jump up and down and tout the machine learning in their products? Is because it's just that much more complicated?
It's more complicated. It's more complicated to make high confidence decisions. And most of the way you see it being used right now is with humans backing it up in some ways. They have a SOC, whether that's a managed SOC or they're running their own SOC, and they're using that data to kind of inform their monitoring strategy in some way. What we're saying is we can do a combination of both. We can look at, you know, how we can prevent a lot of the dumb commodity stuff, and then we can start to focus in on the signal that may be weak model signal, but a human can look at it and say, hey, like, I know that that's problematic. That's,
in our environment, that's bad, right? Yeah. And that's where, you know, we've seen, I think some of the SIEM companies and stuff are looking at building basically machine learning SIEM helpers. I think that's another area where it makes a lot of sense to apply machine learning. I mean, I remember sitting in front of Snort consoles back in the early 2000s, and I'm like, geez, you know, it wouldn't take a particularly complex model to have tune out like 90% of what I was seeing.
Sure. And then what we're really looking at is we're looking at more of what you see machine learning applications doing in like the fraud detection space, right? Where they're sending you a push notification of like, hey, this looks anomalous. Are you buying, you know, gas in Oaxaca, Mexico right now? Or, you know,
Oh, God. I'm amazed, though, some of the transactions that do and do not set that off. Like, I've just, you know, just in my experience of traveling a lot, you know, with a bank with a pretty, you know, active fraud team, the stuff they flag, the stuff they don't flag, it's pretty amazing how often they get it wrong.
Sure. And that's where we're still at. We're not saying that this is perfect. We're saying we want to generate kind of signal.
Yeah, that was actually going to be my next question, which is, you know, do you think that, you know, is Silence going out there and saying, you know, we've cracked EDR because we've got these machine learning models, or are you just pointing at this and saying, this is where we want to go and we think we're going to get there?
We're saying this is the direction we're heading. We're starting where people, if you look at where the EDR space now, it's where, you know, anti-malware, antivirus was 10 years ago. Right. Yeah. We're looking at, okay, we have some heuristics, we have some signatures, we have some early machine learning models. We need to evolve those over time to get better and better. And right now, that's going to take some amount of human engagement. We're going to look to minimize that as much as possible. But over time, it'll get better and better. And eventually, we'll have, you know, really highly effective models that don't take a lot of human interaction to run them.
So I guess, you know, my last question here would be, you know, where's the best place to apply the machine learning model? Is that going to be actually on the hosts, or is it going to be, you know, on the aggregated data that comes from the hosts? Because, well, or both, which I'm guessing is what it's going to be, right?
Yeah, the answer is both. Part of machine learning is having the right data sets and the right corpus. When we can start to identify these patterns in massive data sets, it allows us to start pushing sort of policy and models and adapting to that in near time down to the endpoints. We're not saying that it's real time yet. What we're saying is that we're moving in that direction. And the more data we have, the more we understand compute environments, the more controlled environments we have, the better. But, you know, continuing to deal with the sprawling mass of different compute platforms, applications behaving differently, and we're having to constantly update our models. And so what that'll probably look like from a machine learning standpoint is we're going to go more to weekly supervised or unsupervised models as we get better and better at this.
And I'd imagine too, though, that you're going to be ingesting a lot of logs from your EDR software into your, you know, into some sort of server on your customer's LAN, and there's going to be machine learning applied to that data. That's sort of more what I was asking there.
Oh yeah, everything being consumed and aggregate is absolutely something that's happening now. So yeah. It's not just us. Every EDR player is doing that to some extent right now today.
So that's the difference, is that they're sort of looking at the aggregated data collected by the endpoints, whereas you're sort of trying to push some of that machine learning down to the endpoint itself.
Yes, we're doing both you know, sort of cloud models as well as endpoint models. Whereas the cloud models can be, you know, massive and they can be robust and take a lot of compute. And what we push down to the endpoint is discrete and targeted.
Yeah. All right, Josh Lemos, thank you very much for joining us to have a chat about all of that. It's interesting to, you know, to sort of have a look in the crystal ball and see where, you know, some applied machine learning might fall out. It's been very interesting. Thank you.
Thanks, Patrick.
That was Josh Lemos of Cylance there. Big thanks to him for that. And I'm genuinely curious to see how their efforts progress in this area. And I have a feeling that they should make some headway. So that's one to keep an eye on. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.